We're trying to clarify law. We're trying to set high standards, not ambiguous standards. We can debate this issue all we want, but the practical matter is, if our professionals don't have clear standards in the law, the program is not going to go forward. You cannot ask a young intelligence officer to violate the law, and they're not going to. If there's vague standards applied, like those in Article 3 from the Geneva Convention, it's just not going to go forward.
President Bush speaking at a White House press conference recently. He was answering a question about the debate that's going on between him and the Congress, between him and the Supreme Court, and between him and his own party members on the issue of torture. Now, the president contends, as you heard him say, that the Geneva Convention, Common Article 3, the one often cited against any type of torture, is vague and needs clarification. He's put the ball in Congress's court. We're going to be talking about the Geneva Convention as it pertains to torture of prisoners of war and noncombatants, and the word that most people are using nowadays is simply detainees. Dr. John Warren Montgomery is our guest. Our call-in number is 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. Our in-studio email address is issuesetc@kfuo.org. Dr. Montgomery, before we go on to talk about torture, are you going to stay up for our discussion in the third hour here about this Baptist pastor who leads seminars on hot Christian sex?
Well, of course, I would ordinarily, but unfortunately, my choice is either to go to bed with my wife or to listen to the program, and I've decided to go to bed with my wife.
Good choice. Good choice. That kind of kills two birds with one stone, I think.
It does, yes. Well,
now, the issue of the Geneva Conventions, normally not the topic of dinner time or water cooler conversation here in the U.S., has been bandied about quite a bit in the news here in the States, and it has to do with what the president is contending are vagaries in Article 3 regarding torture. He wants the Congress to clarify what is torture and what isn't torture and what the Geneva Convention prohibits and permits. How would you understand this third article of the Geneva Convention as to the treatment of prisoners of war? Is it vague?
Well, any convention is not going to deal on a case-by-case basis with the issue at hand. What a convention or treaty does is to set forth general principles. And therefore, all treaties and conventions have to be read in their context and in good faith. And it is universally the case in international law that torture is condemned 100% without qualification. The Article 3 of the Geneva Conventions is understood in that way. The European Convention or Treaty on Human Rights regards torture as one of the non-derogable or non-derogable rights, meaning that any country that subscribes, ratifies the European Convention cannot opt out of the torture clause. Torture, then, is simply wrong, and it's wrong in an unqualified fashion. I don't think that Bush is helping himself by trying to get Congress to say what kind of torture you might be able to get away with and what kind of torture you shouldn't get away with. The fact of the matter is that in a democratic society, one with the ideals that the United States has, it has caused an immense amount of trouble for America throughout the world to have been revealed as engaging in what is certainly torture in relation to Guantanamo Bay people and under other conditions as well. We just shouldn't be doing this. How can we go around saying that we are trying to bring democracy, freedom, and human rights to countries that don't have it, and then effectively boil people in oil or psychologically do the equivalent of boiling them in oil?
When the president was answering questions about this on the White House lawn recently from reporters, he cited these particular words from the Common Article 3 in the Geneva Conventions. He said there's a section in there, Section C, that talks about outrages on personal dignity, in particular humiliating, degrading treatment. And he says that's the real thing here. That's short of torture, but what, given people's different customs and different cultures, what is for one man an outrage on personal dignity might be nothing at all to another man. Does he have a point there?
That's quite so. But it's also the case that what is regarded as cruel and unusual punishment is not regarded in the very same way in different cultures. For example, in Europe, the death penalty is considered cruel and unusual punishment, and no European country can ratify the European Convention on Human Rights and become a member of the European community and engage in death penalty actions. So, sure, there are different ways that you can read torture and indignity to the person and so forth, but it seems to me that if America is going to be a beacon light of freedom and human rights, America should err on the side of the angels and not engage in anything that could be considered as an affront to human dignity. If we're in doubt at all on the understanding of the words of the Geneva Convention, then we ought to look as good as possible in relation to the whole thing, not equivocate over what exactly is a loss of personal dignity.
Another objection raised again by the president on this is, look, when we got a hold of some of the masterminds of the 9/11 plots on the U.S., and we tracked them down in Afghanistan, we were able, under the rubric of outrages of personal dignity, and I think in this case they were talking about this thing called waterboarding that gives the subject of it the sense of drowning. We were able to extract information from some of these masterminds that prevented further terrorist attacks that were in the works. How does that argument sound to you?
Well, it's the end justifying the means, of course. Now, there are, you know, in ethics, there are these extreme examples that are always cited. One of these is you capture the bomber who has put TNT in the elementary schools of the city of New York. It's going to blow up school children all over the place, and he will not tell you where he's put the stuff. Now, what do you do under those circumstances? Do you torture him and get him to tell, or what? Well, extreme cases make bad law. There ought to be ways of dealing with the ordinary situation and even the situation in Afghanistan without engaging in that kind of thing. There ought to be. If it turns out to be a lesser of evil situation, then maybe you do this, but you don't try to justify it by squirming around in Article 3 of the Geneva Conventions. You simply admit what you have done, and from a Christian standpoint, you go to the cross and ask forgiveness because what you've done is in fact an evil. It might be a lesser of evils. It might be in this horrible, messy, sinful world that we sometimes end up in contexts where it's better to do that than not. But it certainly can't be justified morally, and it can't be justified legally.
Some would argue that the Geneva Convention doesn't apply to these particular detainees, as they have been called in the past, enemy combatants, because they aren't officially uniformed soldiers under a national flag. How would you respond?
Well, the Supreme Court of the United States took care of that one in the case of Rasul versus Bush. That's Rasul versus Bush. There the argument was that the Guantanamo Bay people did not deserve a trial at all. And the reason is that they were not American citizens, and therefore they didn't come under the protections of the U.S. Constitution, and because of their alleged terrorism, they shouldn't come under the protections of the Geneva Conventions. And the court ruled, and I quote, United States courts have jurisdiction to consider challenges to the legality of the detention of foreign nationals captured abroad in connection with hostilities and incarcerated at Guantanamo Bay. And the reason for this is that in a civilized country, the fact that you capture somebody and he doesn't happen to be an American citizen doesn't mean that you can cart him off somewhere and treat him with impunity in any way you wish. The court also said that Guantanamo Bay was under the entire, the exclusive jurisdiction control of the U.S. government, and therefore these people were no different from any foreigner who happens to turn up on American soil.
I'm Todd Wilkin. You're listening to Issues Etc. We're coming to you live this Wednesday. It's the 20th of September. I want to hear from you on the issue of torture. Our call-in numbers, as we talk with Dr. John Warwick Montgomery, 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. Our in-studio email address, issuesetc@kfuo.org. Our guest, as I said, international human rights and law professor, Dr. John Warwick Montgomery. You spend much of your time, Dr. Montgomery, in England. Do you have any idea where British Prime Minister, at least for the foreseeable future, Tony Blair, stands on the issue of torture?
I don't know what his position is on that, but I am certain that if he were asked point blank, he would say that he was sorry that the coalition between England and the United States has been hurt internationally by what's gone on at Guantanamo Bay. Of course, he's been a wonderful supporter of America in the Iraq situation, but it's been very awkward for him because really the U.S. has attracted unnecessary criticism by the way in which that whole business has been handled. I mean, you can't just grab people and incarcerate them for unspecified periods of time with no opportunity for trial at all. You can't do that. I mean, it's against fundamental American principles to do this. And when people see our inconsistency, you know, then that gives them reason for criticism. It's just like when Christians act inconsistently and against Scripture, it brings down the level of Christian faith.
All right, then here is an objection to the president's position. The president says, look, these articles of the Geneva Convention on the treatment of prisoners of war are vague. Congress needs to clarify them. He says we just need clarity in law. Those who object to the president's position say, look, if we write our own definitions and clarifications for Article 3 of the Geneva Conventions, then everyone else will feel free to write their own definitions, and that will put our servicemen, if captured or detained, perhaps under the threat of torture.
Yeah, I think that's a very strong argument. We don't want everybody going around with different definitions. Insofar as possible, what we want to do is to encourage people to minimize any activity which is an affront to human dignity.
Then someone says, look, this is war. War is different than peace. Our enemies, the terrorists, they're not even going to pay attention to the Geneva Convention rules, if they even know they exist. So why are we worried about it?
Well, we're worried about it because we don't want to become like them. The whole idea is to maintain a different perspective on life and human dignity. And if we descend to their level, then we obviously are not going to be able to argue that our lifestyle is worth promoting over against theirs.
The president's argument, at least of late, and he actually is formulating apparently some kind of a compromise with the Congress that hasn't been disclosed, but of the latest statement, his argument is, look, it all comes down to these faithful American professionals, as he calls them, interrogators, who simply can't do their job if they don't know what they're permitted and not permitted to do. They don't know if they're breaking the law or not when they interrogate either prisoners of war, detainees, or civilian combatants.
Oh, I don't agree with that at all. They know perfectly well what they're doing. If you subject someone to a hideous fear of death by drowning, you know perfectly well that you are violating the dignity of that person. The interrogators ought to be instructed to err on the side of not engaging in this kind of thing rather than engaging in it. There was very, very effective interrogations carried on during the Second World War, particularly in England, of German officers. This was done by the interrogator ingratiating himself, speaking the language, and finally getting the prisoner to take a different viewpoint. Now, with terrorists, I agree, the chances of that are virtually nil, but then we have to find other ways of counteracting terrorism besides torture, for goodness sake. I mean, one way of doing it, of course, is to clean out these nests of terrorists.
We're talking with Dr. John Warwick Montgomery. Our subject is torture. We're coming to you live this Wednesday. It's the 20th of September. Our call-in number is 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. About 10 minutes left with Dr. Montgomery. Our in-studio email address, issuesetc@kfuo.org. Linda calls from St. Charles. Hi, Linda.
I probably am going to sound like a real creepo here, but what about what they're beheading people and taping it and showing it on air and doing all this other stuff? What the heck do they get to do? I mean, I just don't think that's right. And if they're going to do that to us, I'm sorry, but maybe I'm probably wrong. But I think it's terrible what they're doing.
All right, Linda, thank you very much. She voices, I think, a sentiment fairly common among the American people. How would you respond, Dr. Montgomery?
Well, of course it's terrible what they're doing, but if we do the same sort of thing, then there's no distinction between them and us. And if there's no distinction, then do we have any right to condemn them, and do we have any right to push our lifestyle and our values in contexts where they are not accepted? Seems to me that the fact, for example, that the Nazi leaders in the Second World War put Jews into gas chambers and made lampshades out of their skin and that sort of thing, would that have given us the right to do the same sort of thing to Hitler and Goering and Goebbels and the rest of them? Of course not. Of course not. I mean, the Russians probably would have done this if they'd had the chance. But thank goodness there were the Nuremberg War Crimes Trials that showed that we were a society of law and not a society that was simply engaged in recriminatory action.
Let's talk about the evidence side of this, if we could, Dr. Montgomery. And that is, two questions kind of rise to the top here. First of all, is evidence or testimony that is derived by means of torture, let's just say real bona fide torture that everyone agrees is a torture, is it reliable?
No, it's not. And in any ordinary legal context, such testimony is inadmissible. I mean, you can't have forced testimony admitted in court against anybody, I mean, whether it's civil or criminal.
Let's talk with Tim, who calls from his car. Tim, welcome to Issues, Etc.
Oh, thank you for taking my call. Earlier, the gentleman made the point that that these examples of obtaining information because someone put bombs in schools is an extreme law school case. But at the same time, we're in an extreme situation. And my second point is the idea that we're in a moral equivalency with these terrorists. We haven't cut anybody's head off. We haven't tortured anybody the way they've tortured our people. After Abu Ghraib, the terrorists captured a couple of our servicemen, and they declared they were going to do to our people what we did to them at Abu Ghraib. And I thought, great, we'll get them back with underwear on their head.
All right, thank you very much for the call. Let's see what Dr. Montgomery has to say. Respond to both of those comments. The first one being,
it's certainly an extreme situation today. There's no doubt about it. And as I said earlier, I can certainly conceive of a rare number of cases where it would be a lesser of evils to extract information where the lives of many other people were in peril. But that doesn't make it a moral good. It is still an evil, and it's only because of the hideous fallen nature of our world that we get into dilemmas of this kind. The trouble with the approach of messing with Article 3 of the Geneva Conventions is that this is an effort to try to justify doing this kind of thing. It can't be justified. It can't be justified morally. It can't be justified legally. It may turn out to be necessary under certain conditions, but that doesn't make it morally right.
Dr. Montgomery, would you give us a few more minutes on the other side of our break?
My generosity is well known.
Thank you very much. This is an email, and we might have to wait until after the break for you to respond to it in full. Roy writes this: sometimes your current guest makes excellent sense. In this afternoon's discussion, he is off base in a number of ways. For one, and we'll respond to this on the other side of the break, for one, the president has not requested the Congress authorize torture. I note that some international human rights groups have indicated that almost anything short of treating detainees as full-fledged POWs constitutes torture, but this is not what is at issue here. Dr. Montgomery is also totally off base in blithely assuming that the U.S. has clearly engaged in torture of detainees at Guantanamo. This would only be true if he's equating indefinite detention as torture. When we come back from this break, Dr. Montgomery will get his opportunity to respond to that first of Roy's objections via the email. Our call-in numbers, 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. Our in-studio email address, issuesetc@kfuo.org, issuesetc@kfuo.org. We're talking with Dr. John Warwick Montgomery. He's Professor Emeritus at the University of Luton in England. He is a French advocate, a barrister at law in England and Wales, and a member of the Bar of the Supreme Court of the United States. He's Distinguished Professor of Apologetics and the History of Christian Thought at Trinity College and Theological Seminary, Director of the International Academy of Apologetics, Evangelism, and Human Rights, and he has authored and edited more than 50 books, including Christians in the Public Square. By the way, in the beginning of our conversation, we had talked a bit about the time I spent with Dr. Montgomery and with Craig Parton and with the 25 students at the International Academy of Apologetics, Evangelism, and Human Rights in Strasbourg, France this summer. It was definitely a time to remember. The students were excellent. The instruction was excellent. I benefited from sitting at the feet of Dr. Montgomery as he instructed the students, and Craig Parton as well. I only wish I could have stuck around to hear Gary Habermas hold forth in the week that followed there. Not only that, but I had the privilege of being able to travel around that region of France near Strasbourg and see it presented to me with all of its splendor by Dr. Montgomery himself, who is obviously a great lover of Strasbourg, that city, and of its environment. For more information on this academy, the International Academy of Apologetics, Evangelism, and Human Rights, that's held every summer in Strasbourg, France, check out the What's New section of our website. You'll find a link to the 11th Annual Summer Study of the International Academy of Apologetics, Evangelism, and Human Rights right there. Issuesetc.org. Click What's New when you get there. Issuesetc.org. Click What's New. Now, I will warn you, there are a very limited number of spaces for applicants to the Academy. It is well worth your time there, this two-week residential program in Strasbourg, France. But I think this next year, if I'm not mistaken, they're only going to take 20 students. So that means you need to register and register soon. Go to our website, issuesetc.org, click What's New, and you'll find more information and a brochure on the 11th Annual Summer Study of the International Academy of Apologetics, Evangelism, and Human Rights. When we come back, Dr. Montgomery's been kind enough to give us a few more minutes of his time. We'll take your phone calls, and we'll get his response to Roy's objection that he sent us via the email. Stay tuned.
Talk radio for the thinking Christian. You're listening to Issues, Etc. Larry Rast, Arthur Just, Carl Fakencher, Kurt Marquardt, Peter Scare, Cameron McKenzie.
You probably recognize these names as regular guests on Issues, Etc. But what else do they have in common? Well, they're all members of the Christ-centered, cross-focused faculty of Concordia Theological Seminary in Fort Wayne, Indiana.
Dean Wenthy, Walter A. Meyer II, David Scare, Dan Gard, Charles Geeshan, Bill Weinrich.
Have you ever considered the pastoral ministry? Concordia Theological Seminary, Fort Wayne, Indiana. For more information, go to our website, issuesetc.org, or call them 1-800-481-2155. Preparing Christ-centered, cross-focused pastors for the 21st century. Concordia Theological Seminary, Fort Wayne, Indiana.
John Pless, Hal Senkbeil, Richard Muller, Roland Ziegler.
This is Family News in Focus. I'm Bob Dittmer. Pedophiles spend millions of dollars a month using credit cards to access child porn websites. Child advocates want to eradicate the problem by 2008, an aggressive goal. But they believe the target is reachable by cutting off the money supply. Josh Montez reports on a simple solution that could yield tremendous results.
A year ago, Congress challenged child advocates to work with bankers to cut the financial lifeline to child porn websites. Ernie Allen with MissingKids.com was on Capitol Hill yesterday to report growing success.
Financial industry leaders who represent 87% of the U.S. payments industry, measured in dollars running through the system, have signed on.
It's called the Financial Coalition Against Child Pornography, which includes 18 major banks and credit card companies. All are implementing a zero-tolerance policy of dealing with pornographers who pose as legitimate businesses. Mark McCarthy with Visa says they're being proactive.
In August of this year, our search firm examined over 11 million internet sites a day and found two child pornography sites that accepted Visa cards. Of course, that's too many. Since the beginning of this year, 9 such sites have been identified in the Visa system, and all of these sites were quickly expelled from our system.
While some see pornography as a victimless crime, a position refuted by women and family groups, Janice Krause with Concerned Women for America says child pornography leaves a trail of broken lives that no one denies.
Even if it's not completely wiped out, if we make significant progress forward, that's going to save the lives of hundreds, if not thousands, of children.
International banks are urged to join the coalition because child porn is a global problem. For Family News in Focus, I'm Josh Montez.
5 years ago, law enforcement officials shut down a website based in Texas that was raking in $2 million a month through online credit card transactions. For Family News in Focus, I'm Bob Dittmer.
Here's a special AM850 KFUO salute to our day sponsor on this Wednesday, September 20th, 2006, Frank Kern. Today's day sponsor has made a contribution to AM850 KFUO in loving memory of Marilyn Kern. Once again, a very special thank you to Frank Kern of Rolla, Missouri, today's AM850 KFUO day sponsor. Our Issues Etc. book of the month for September is actually a CD and a booklet. It's titled Listening to Luther. For more information, call Concordia Publishing House, 1-800-325-3040, or visit our website, issuesetc.org. The CD contains a recording of Luther's Small Catechism and hymns by Martin Luther. The booklet contains a history of the Small Catechism and several of Martin Luther's hymns, including the text. Listening to Luther, our Issues Etc. book of the month.
Welcome back to Issues Etc. Dr. John Warren Montgomery has agreed to give us a few more minutes here. He's an international human rights attorney and law professor. We're talking about torture. Our call-in number is 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. And our in-studio email address, issuesetc@kfuo.org. Dr. Montgomery, before the break, I read the first part of Roy's email objecting to some of the things you said. Here is how he finishes off that email. The president has asked that Congress provide some specification as to what conduct would violate the provisions of Common Article 3 of the Geneva Convention. We are not talking about provisions related to prisoners of war. The argument that others would define the vague terms in the Common Article 3 is off base because, in fact, everyone responsible for prisoners or detainees does apply their own interpretation. Which is better, asks Roy, to have a definite interpretation that will undoubtedly safeguard detainees from conduct that most of us would consider torture or humiliating and degrading, or to leave the vague language undefined, says Roy. Your response?
Well, I would be very happy if internationally there were an effort to be a bit more specific. In other words, if it were possible to do a an addendum to Article 3 of the Geneva Conventions, so that internationally there would be the same standard applied. But I am definitely against any single nation attempting to do this kind of thing, because that will simply encourage a variation of national interpretations. I come back to the point that I made previously. If there is vagueness here, the way to solve this is to err on the side of not doing anything that would be regarded as an affront to human dignity. And we know perfectly well what that kind of conduct consists of. We have no difficulty with that whatsoever.
Should the detainees, be they those who the CIA have been holding in various clandestine prisons for the last 3 or 4 years, or those at Guantanamo Bay, should they simply be declared to be prisoners of war, given that classification? Then we can deal with them on that definite basis of the Geneva Conventions?
Well, it doesn't really make any difference, according to the Supreme Court of the United States, how we designate them. The fact of the matter is that they, as foreigners, detained on American soil, on soil which is leased to the United States on a permanent basis and solely under the control of the United States, those people have to be brought to trial. They can't just be detained without any formal legal action against them. To do that is no different at all in principle from doing this to anybody in New York City or St. Louis, Missouri. I mean, do we grab people and detain them because there's a strong suspicion that they need to be punished? Of course not. That's not the way a civilized society handles its enemies and its opponents.
How would you respond to someone who says, look, the Geneva Conventions were written in a time when national armies came against one another under the national flags, when you knew who the enemy was and the enemy was self-identified. This simply is a different kind of war, and the Geneva Conventions hardly even bear upon what we have to deal with. We've got to write new rules for all of this stuff.
Well, actually, the Geneva Conventions have sections and appendices that deal with the distinction between combatants and non-combatants, and those that are passing themselves off as civilians when they are in fact combatants. There are actually four Geneva Conventions, four of them, and they are far more detailed than one might imagine from these comments we've been making on Article 3 of one of the conventions. So it would seem to me that one should look at them very closely to see the degree of applicability that they represent. I think it would be desirable, as I mentioned before, to have addenda to these conventions that would deal more specifically with the problem of the terrorist. But regardless of whether or not we do this, we are still going to have this very same issue of torture present. And the issue of torture does not depend upon whether they are terrorists or whether they are combatants in the traditional sense of the word. You don't do this in either case.
Finally then, Dr. Montgomery, what is ultimately at stake with the issue of torture?
Well, I believe that the issue is whether or not we see our value system as something that must not be compromised because of the nature of the enemy we face. I think that's the issue. If we descend to the level of our enemies, we are destroying ourselves in the course of doing this. We've got to be rigorous in our fight against terrorism, but we mustn't compromise our own values in the course of doing this.
Dr. John Warwick Montgomery is Professor Emeritus at the University of Luton in England. Kind enough to stick around for a few extra minutes here on Issues Etc. He's a French advocate, a barrister at law in England and Wales, a member of the Bar of the Supreme Court, of the United States. He serves as Distinguished Professor of Apologetics and the History of Christian Thought at Trinity College and Theological Seminary, and he directs the International Academy of Apologetics, Evangelism, and Human Rights. He's authored and edited over 50 books, including Christians in the Public Square. Dr. Montgomery, thank you very much for being our guest.
Oh, you're most welcome. Carry on.
Thank you, and thanks for sticking around a few extra minutes past your bedtime. Well, LCMS World Relief deals on the other side with the subject, many of the subjects we've been talking about here. Human rights are taking a battering wherever human beings are found in so many places in the globe. And the fallout of that more philosophical issue of whether or not human rights are respected worldwide are the real human victims. So when you read about the victims of man-made disasters, whether it be famine and starvation in Darfur or elsewhere in the world, think of LCMS World Relief. Their solution to this is not only to reach out with that touch of mercy, caring for the needs of the body, but also for the need of the soul, the need for a Savior, Jesus Christ. The message of the cross goes with their touch of mercy and their relief efforts worldwide. Find out more about what Pastor Matt Harrison and LCMS World Relief are doing worldwide to bring this Christ-centered, cross-focused relief effort. Go to our website, issuesetc.org. Look for their logo on our homepage or call them toll-free 1-888-930-4438, 1-888-930-4438. For the next few minutes of the program, Bill Beckman is our guest. He's Executive Director of Illinois Right to Life. On today's Metro section, Section B there in the Illinois section of the St. Louis Post-Dispatch, the Illinois edition, the headline reads, State Justices Reviving Abortion Law. I didn't even know there was one on the books, and I've lived in Illinois for a long, long time. Bill Beckman, welcome to Issues Etc. The newspaper is calling this law about parental notification in Illinois a dormant state law on parental notification. How is it that there's been a law on the books, but it hasn't been implemented in Illinois requiring parental notification for someone under 17 to get an abortion in Illinois?
Well, this law was passed in 1995 and signed by then-Governor Edgar. But the unusual thing that happened was that the Supreme Court needed to write some judicial bypass rules so that the law could go into effect, because there's always a judicial bypass provision that's required in these kind of laws. So if the teenager appeals to say that it's going to endanger me if my parents got involved. And so the Supreme Court rejected their responsibility to write those rules, and that put the law in a state of incompleteness. So the federal court, at the request of those opposing the law, basically enjoined it and said this law can't go into effect because it doesn't have all the components required. And it's been sitting there in that condition ever since that time.
So just to answer this for me, because it's not clear from the news stories, did the Supreme Court at the time in 1995 when the law was passed just simply use this procedure to kill the law, in effect?
Well, that's certainly the suspicion from people on the pro-life side, is to say that, you know, that this was a political act by the court, because there's no precedent, there's no legal justification. And as a matter of fact, in a friend of the court brief that was issued trying to encourage the court to now do take action on this, the lack of proper logic in the justification that was issued by the court then on why they didn't take the action was effectively, shown to be, very faulty on all counts by the information that was submitted. So there really wasn't any valid legal justification. So it had to be a political act by people that wanted to kill the law.
There is also a federal injunction against this parental notification law in place, even if the Supreme Court comes up with those rules and gets the law going. What is that about?
Well, okay, because of this, of course, the injunction was put in place because the rules didn't exist. So now that the rules will exist, then the proper course of action is that the Attorney General of the State of Illinois, Lisa Madigan, needs to go back to the federal court and say, we have the rules now, we're asking you to lift the injunction. So the first step then would be that the Attorney General needs to take that step. Now, at this point in time, the information I've heard is that there seems to be expectation she will do that. There apparently will be pressure on her to effectively become another roadblock in the process and basically not do her job and just say, you know, I'm not going to do that. So I don't really know. At this point, we'll have to wait and see, you know, once the rules are promulgated, you know, whether or not she'll take that step and make that request to the federal court. But if she does, then they basically at the federal court level would now look at the rules and say these rules pass muster or they don't. We would expect that most likely that, you know, since all the things that have gone over the dam so far, that they would have gone through the trouble of writing the rules correctly and that the federal court would say, yes, the injunction can be removed. At that point in time, the law should go into effect. The only possibility would be that the people opposed to the law would bring some other, case to the court, try to snag the law on some other issue, and then that would have to be considered by the federal court again to evaluate whether or not there was any merit to their case. And we don't believe that they would have anything to go on that would be legitimate, so it'd just probably be a delaying tactic again to see if they could manage to slow down the law being coming in effect.
So the law's been effectively dormant for 11 years since
Correct.
Passage. What has changed recently so that now the court is willing to sit down, write the judicial bypass rules that will allow this law to take effect?
Well, this is where one of the things that has changed is that there's a new Chief Justice, Bob Thomas, and he has had a track record of being recognized as having a pro-life position. So at least according to the quotes coming out in the press information, it seems to suggest that he was intending to do this, and apparently in his new position as Chief Justice that he did discuss it with the other justices. The good news to me is in the article that appeared in the Chicago Tribune that he convinced all the justices that this was a legitimate action. So even though there's currently 4 Democrats and 3 Republicans is what's going to compose the Supreme Court of Illinois, that they all voted unanimously that these rules should be issued. So the people that are now claiming that this is a political act don't really have a whole lot of merit on which to base that claim, because it doesn't make a whole lot of sense that you've got 4 Democrats and 3 Republicans voting to do something, and they're claiming this is some kind of a partisan act or a political act.
Still, then, how would you respond to the comments made by a representative from the Illinois Planned Parenthood Council in the paper saying that this is highly suspicious on the part of the Supreme Court of Illinois, and especially that it comes, quote, just 2 months before the gubernatorial election in that state?
Well, I think they're trying to come to their own conclusions for their own political purposes, because, I mean, the court just went back into session, so it would be logical, based on the timing of the court and not based on the timing of the election, that the court would basically make a decision to take some action like this. And since Thomas has just become the Chief Justice, and if he, you know, had convinced the other justices this was a logical thing to do, he's not looking at the political clock. He's just looking at this is right to do. We've been sitting on it for 11 years. It's about time we did something.
So then, with only about 30 seconds, where is this going from now? Realistically, what's going to happen to this parental notification law in Illinois?
Well, I would say that on a hopeful basis that this could actually go through all the remaining hurdles over some number of months, certainly less than a year, and that it actually would be come into effect. You know, but we'll have to allow the things to play out to see if that can really happen. But hopefully we should be able to expect that to happen.
Finally, Bill, do we have any pro-life candidates running for statewide office in Illinois in the upcoming election?
Unfortunately, at the statewide level, the true pro-life candidates are very, you know, slim pickings. I mean, there are really very few to choose from, and unfortunately, we have, you know, other races at, like, you know, individual state senate or federal U.S. representatives, and that they're very important races where there is clearly a choice between a pro-life and a pro-abortion candidate. But at the statewide level, very, very slim.
Bill Beckman is Executive Director of Illinois Right to Life. IllinoisRightToLife.org is their website address, IllinoisRightToLife.org. Bill, thank you for being our guest.
Thank you very much, Todd.
I emphatically declare that today's world, more than ever before, longs for just and righteous people with love for all humanity. and above all, longs for the perfect, righteous human being and the real Savior who has been promised to all peoples and who will establish justice, peace, and brotherhood on the planet. O Almighty God, all men and women are your creatures, and you have ordained their guidance and salvation. Bestow upon humanity that thirst for justice, the perfect human being promised to all by you, and make us among his followers and among those who strive for his return and his cause.
متشکرم و السلام علیکم و رحمت الله و برکاته.
Those are the words of Iranian President Ahmadinejad. He is speaking at the UN, and in those final words of his speech to the UN Assembly this week in New York, he mentioned twice a perfect human being that he believes is going to appear in the world and bring justice and peace. He even ended his remarks to the UN with a prayer to Allah to that effect. We're going to be talking here for the remainder of this hour with Dr. Alvin Schmidt about the apocalyptic vision of Iran's president, and we'll also take up the subject of President Bush's comments at the UN yesterday on Islam. Dr. Alvin Schmidt is a regular guest professor emeritus of sociology at Illinois College and author of the book The Great Divide: The Failure of Islam and the Triumph of the West. Dr. Schmidt, welcome back.
Oh, thank you.
All right, what is this? Can you sort this out? What the president of Iran mentioned, a perfect human being that he expects to appear soon and bring justice to the entire planet?
Yes, this is what's referred to. By the way, this is part of the Shiites' religion or belief. It's not part of the Sunnis, and as you know, the Shiites make up a roughly 15% of all Muslims, so 85% of the Muslims do not follow this particular teaching. But what it says is this: there were 11 imams in the Shiite theology. By the way, all of them got killed or by the sword or by poison. The 12th one. Disappeared in his youth, some say around 5 or 6 years of age, out of sight, and that he would come back sometime, someday, and that's what he's referring to. He is an essence or kind of Messiah. And this is what Ahmadinejad has been promoting, and he has in many speeches mentioned this individual. He would bring back a millennium, so to speak, where peace and justice would prevail. But before that, you would have what is called the Red Death would take place, namely by the sword. You would have a massive White Death, which would be a plague. And the sun would rise in the west. Get that? It would rise in the west. And Muslims would cast out all non-Muslims. And I said that is basically the belief that he would come back, and many of them believe that Ahmadinejad believes that his coming back is pretty close at hand. And so that's in essence what this is about.
The words he used there for this perfect human being that Ahmadinejad expects is the world's true savior.
That's right.
What does he mean by that from a Shia Islamic perspective? I know what Christians mean by the world's true savior.
Well, you know, it's interesting in this whole theology a bit, they even pull in Jesus to some extent. This individual is often referred to as Mahdi, spelled M-A-H-D-I or M-E-H-D-I. For example, that Mahdi will someday come, and there will be a great victory against the Christians. And this war will then be a type of Armageddon. It will end up with the victory of Muslims against the Romans, which is often referred to in times past, which again refers to the West. Muslims will take over the capital of Rome, which could be any city today. And in the seventh year, the Antichrist would appear, and a greater war will start between Jews and Muslims that will last for 40 days. And by the way, those 40 days will be longer than usual days. And will end with when Jesus will come, And here's where Jesus gets introduced. And the Muslims will kill all Jews, and all the people will convert to Islam, and peace will then pervade the whole world. That's that's basically what Ahmadinejad and the Shiite Muslims believe.
Were you surprised to hear Ahmadinejad mention this apocalyptic figure when he's addressing the UN ostensibly about nuclear arms and things like that?
In that sense, I was. Perhaps that he did it at the UN, but I wasn't totally surprised because he's done it in a number of other speeches that we have not heard about, but that I've read about. So, yeah, to some extent, I am surprised that he did it over here at the UN and to people who know little or anything about this particular doctrine.
Is Ahmadinejad particularly fanatical among the Shia about this apocalyptic vision,
or is
he representative?
That's a good question. Many believe he's more fanatical about it than many others who believe in this messianic kind of coming back on the part of the 12th Imam. I don't know. That's about all I can say. Who will know for sure whether he is more? But he's certainly more vocal than anybody has been for a long time in the Shiite circles.
What is it, as you observe both the geopolitical realm and what you know of Islam, and in particular of Shiite Islam, what do you think Ahmadinejad expects to happen in the next couple of years? What is he looking for?
Well, some people even believed this summer back in August. There were a couple of days that they thought he might do something drastic to help usher in this event. Obviously, that didn't happen. And some people believe that if he got the atomic bomb to use, then maybe that would be it.
So do you think his nuclear ambitions, such as they are...
Well, I think we can't divorce him from that at all. If we are, I just think we're naive. I really do believe, given this man, I really do think that's part of the part of his whole political, religious agenda.
All right, then I guess this will help us segue nicely to what we're going to talk about on the other side of the break. Given the fact that the president, at least publicly, has made it quite clear, even to the UN, that he does not consider Islam per se as a religious system part of the problem. In fact, we got a piece of audio we'll play for you on the other side of the break for your reaction, Dr. Schmidt, where he says it might even be part of the solution to world peace. Given those public statements by the president, do you think that the current administration was paying attention to the last two paragraphs of that speech and realize the possible import of what it may mean politically in the world?
I don't know. I have my doubts.
Do they need to?
Yeah, I think so.
When we come back from this break, we'll have a few more minutes with Dr. Alvin Schmidt talking about the apocalyptic vision of Iran's president, Ahmadinejad. And when we come back, we're going to have another piece of audio from the UN, this time President Bush speaking to the General Assembly there in New York. He expressed some great hopes. He says, look, we respect Islam, and with Islam's help, we can bring the peace and keep the peace. We'll play that audio and get Dr. Schmidt's reaction on the other side of this break. Then we're going to start audio open lines for your questions and your comments. We've got an ABC News story on Pope Benedict's latest comment regarding his remarks last week on Islam. That story continues. And NBC has a news feature on a Baptist preacher who leads seminars on hot Christian sex. In an era of full-service churches, is this a service you expect from your church? A seminar on steamy sex and how to have it? I want your answer to that question on the other side of this break with Audio Open Lines.
Equipping the priesthood of all believers. You're listening to Issues, Etc.